Summer's here, and Nordstrom has everything you need for your best dress season ever. From beach days and weddings to weekend getaways and your everyday wardrobe, discover stylish options under $100 from tons of your favorite brands like Mango, Skims, Princess Polly, and Madewell. It's easy, too, with free shipping and free returns, in-store order pickup, and more. Shop today in-stores, online at Nordstrom.com, or download the Nordstrom app.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. Knowing you could be saving money for the things you really want, like that dream house or ride, is a great feeling. That's why the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you save when you choose to bundle home and auto. Bundling, just another way to save with a personal price plan. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis and today I'm with Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Dennis. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. So the reason why I asked you on, you did a presentation at SOMHSA 25. On the other 19% females in the battlefield. And I thought it was a really good talk. And so I invited you to come on and I tricked you. So you're here. But before we start, would you mind doing a quick introduction to yourself?
Sure. Master Sergeant Dan McGarra. I have a little over 22 years now in the military. The majority of that in special operations. I joined special operations in 2006 after joining in 2002 as a combat medic. Did a couple tours as a route clearance medic in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then a few more tours to many paid vacations around the world with special operations. And currently I am retiring as the senior enlisted medical advisor to SOCSNET down here in MacDill Air Force Base near Tampa.
Nice. Well, starting off, like, females on the battlefield, way back in my day, like, that was not even a thing. But now it is. So, I guess, what's the problem? Like, if it works on men, shouldn't it work on women? Like, I guess, why is there even a problem to have a discussion about?
So, it comes about that there's been a number of case studies that have been done over roughly the last 10, 15 years now. A couple of docs that came from the JMU started it down at JBSA. AJ, one of the orthopedic surgeons, he started it off with a couple other docs, and it has slowly progressed. Now, University of Minnesota has got a few contracts, and even USHU. They've got about 7 or 8 different case studies pending, and a couple that have already been completed that are showing some disparity and some discrepancies on trauma treatment between the genders. Specifically more on the male treating a female casualty, that there are some uncomfortable truths. Everybody thinks that it's just gender neutral and everybody's going to treat everybody because everybody's equal, and it's not true. Consistently, it is showing that there are going to be some issues. And the potentiality of increased fatality rates among females to males with the same injury patterns has been noted. In the end, as females continue to increase in their numbers, so when I first wrote my thesis back in 2017-2018, females made 16% of the total DOD. Now they make 19%, they're going on 20% of the DOD. Just last year, the Army had a 38% increase in female recruiting from the previous year. As men, fighting age males continue to decrease. So again, when I wrote my thesis about 8 years ago, 26% of fighting age males, so 18 to 24 year olds in America, were eligible for the military. Now that's down to 22%. So the military is having, as a whole, some issues trying to get more men in, so they're shifting around and trying to figure out ways to mitigate some of the decline. I noticed last year that they're doing a little bit better and their recruiting efforts are getting there, but again, It's because the females are making up some of the difference there. So as we see this, and with what we've seen with ISIS and what we've seen in Ukraine, there have been a lot more female casualties on the battlefield. Even with like the Kurds recreating entire infantry battalions to fight ISIS. And one of the reasons was a psychological warfare aspect. If you were killed by a woman in combat, you didn't get to go to heaven. So they would put these women on the front lines as they were about to attack a city or a town on loudspeakers. And their battalion commander, Sergeant Major, would get on the loudspeakers and say, "You're fighting the first all-female Kurdish battalion. Prepare to die and go to hell." And then they would launch their barrage and attack. And you would see on ISR, some of the ISIS fighters would run away from the frontline positions because they didn't want to get killed by a woman. And that's what they were thinking. It was a very intriguing methodology for psychological warfare in that aspect. Fast forward a few years to Ukraine now, and I was just watching one of the presentations from the Ukrainians that 21% of their medevac was dedicated to females. I did get a question that was a really good question, and it kind of goes along with what my thesis was writing about. I was like, "Oh, was that all military females?" And I was like, "You know what? It actually didn't. It didn't delineate that I remember that they were military females. It was just females in general. It was 79-21 for their medevac." But that was part of my thesis. It was like, I'm not just worried about the active duty and the military females. I'm also talking about the NGOs that are caught in the crossfire. I'm talking about the civilians that are caught in the crossfire. And if we're not knowing what we're doing on female treatment and some of the considerations that we should have for differences in physiology and just differences in social cultural concerns, then how many of these women are not going to make it because we're not thinking this through and we're not having these discussions to prep the next generation of medics for the next war?
Yeah. So, I mean, what are some of the discrepancies that were actually causing real problems?
So one of the ones that came up, so the crack with to do a crack on women, one of the case studies that did show it was 36 men and 36 women were done in a hospital by anesthesiologists, and I believe it was 31 or 32 females were missed out of 36. So a large proportion, I want to say it was 11 of the males were missed. And the only section in that case study that I wish they had actually shown was that the BMI for the men. I'm wondering if a number of those men, of the 11 that were missed, were obese, and that was why they couldn't find that. They couldn't find the Adam's apple. They couldn't find the landmarks because only like 12% of women even have something like a landmark for an Adam's apple and having that identifying mark. Not to mention, majority of women are going to be a little bit thicker than the fighting age male. And so with that, it's going to be a little bit harder. All the mannequins and all the models that we're using, they're based on male anatomy with a really nice Adam's apple and just beautiful landmarks. You're not going to have that if you're working on a lot of females or any females, honestly. You're not going to have that beautiful landmark where you're going to just run your finger down and be like, "Oh, there it is. I know."
So differences in crike and, I mean, anything else?
Another one is hypothermia, so body surface area, muscle mass. That was another concern that females are not able to compensate for lethal triad in that portion with hypothermia. The active shivering is going to help with combating a little bit of the hypothermia aspect, but as men are larger, have more muscle mass and body surface area, they can compensate a little bit longer for the hypothermia effects versus a female that would have the same injury pattern as a male. So if you only have one HPMK, you have a male and a female patient with the same exact injury patterns, for example, who would you use the HPMK on? Yes, you can cut the heat sheet in half and you can do your best, but who is going to be the one that is going to have the biggest issues? The other aspects of physiology, breasts, you have large breasts, small breasts, men not feeling comfortable with touching them, they could get in the way, and that was where I know when Kazi did make that change on the needle decompression site, that it would have been an argument for a few years that, well, if you have a large amount of tissue on the chest and it's flipping over, you know, the second intercostal space here, why are we not going to say that this is it? And that's where they shifted from primary resonator primary and secondary sites. And then they were like, okay, yeah, no, we can go, you know, now shooter's preference, you know, use what you can because taking body armor off and all these other arguments came up. But yeah, another one that came up from a couple of the female docs that I talked with was, okay, what if they were breastfeeding? One of my teammates, when we deployed, she still had a pump. So if I'm stabbing needles in her chest and like she has this in the way, like what are the secondary effects of going through a milk duct? And that milk leaking into the chest cavity and the lung space and all that. I was like, oh man. And one of the doctors was like, yeah, we're not even going to talk about that. Like, that's just going to cause issues. But yes, haven't seen it personally, but yes, that could be a problem. I was like, okay, well, but like I have a small team. I already have one female that is doing that. So what do I need to consider? And they're like, just go to the side. I was like, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. And I mean, I noticed this when I train other guys, a super simple thing. If I want to throw some chaos into the situation, you make the patient a female. Or we have a critical male casualty and a very much not critical female casualty. You want to split the team apart and destroy continuity. More than half the guys will run to the female and do absolutely everything they can, and they'll let the male die. Why is this even a problem? Like, I kind of thought we were medical professionals.
So that is, it's one of the things I did get to moonlight with Griffin Group for a number of years, about 10 years ago or so, when they still had some JMU personnel working out there. And it was consistent. When we were running scenarios, they had live male and female actors that would come in and create moulage, and they would set everything else up. And it was consistently happening that whenever we threw a female into the mix, it was throwing these guys out of whack for the first couple iterations, to the point that the director that was running it, he wound up getting video cameras installed because they were getting into such nasty arguments about it. I didn't do that. I was like, dude, we literally watch you run in the room. Your 18 Delta is treating the one female. You have a couple other male patients in the room. The female starts crying or says, oh no, you're killing me, stop that. And you literally grabbed your guy by his kit and threw him about 10 feet across the room and said, I'll fix this. And then the patient still died because you don't know what you're doing as well as your 18 Delta did. And they're like, I didn't do that. And I was like, and roll footage. And then we'd have a nice little flat screen come out and we would roll footage and everybody would be staring at it. And the guy would just kind of like look down and look at us from the side. And we're like, so we do this for a reason, because we have noticed consistently for a few years that your first run or two, you guys are going to be completely like losing your minds because you hear a woman crying and it is affecting you on a social cultural angle. I call it like the gentleman complex. Like, you were raised, you were there to protect, you were there to do this. This is ingrained in your DNA. At the end of the day, we're not worried about men and women and who's being treated first. We're worried about who needs to be triaged and who needs to be treated by triage, which is gender neutral. Most of the time, what we did, and like you said, is like we would injure the female, but not horribly. We'd injure them a little bit here and there, give them some moderate injuries that they could die from, but we would have a really seriously injured male and then a moderately injured additional male in some cases, just to watch them go through the scenario. And at the end of the day, it took them two full runs to break it. And when we got typically to a third run, everybody was hopping and popping the way they were supposed to do it. And they would come in the room, and the medic would take a step back, and he would analyze, do the triage properly, or the corpsman, and then everybody would start falling in line like they were supposed to do in a real medical emergency. It was just very interesting now that USU and the University of Minnesota and some others, they have ongoing case studies right now. In fact, USU just closed out their case study at the end of last year in Mexico, and they were finding the same issues. They were having some very difficult times with the males trying to treat females, and even in vice versa, where the females were having issues trying to treat the males because they were worried about social cultural issues. exposing the patient's breasts, exposing genitalia on both genders, they all were saying the same thing, that they just felt very uncomfortable by it, and they didn't know what to do without getting in trouble with their chain of command or just with their fellow soldiers around them. I say this as the conversation we had about what Stacey Shackelford hit me with one time, and she was like, okay, we've had a number of people get blown up from underneath, male genitalia, you know, her personal issues, like I've seen, you know, like half a dozen of these guys come in, genital urinal issues, you know, the genitalia mangled, and like people are able to clamp and, you know, put some combat gauze in there and get them back to the roll two, roll three. He's like, but what if you have a female and you can actively see it is bleeding from inside of her and is shooting out? Do you feel comfortable enough as a soft medic to take that combat gauze and shove it up inside of her between her legs while her entire team is now staring at you? And I was like, oh, that's a good one. Wow, I would have to talk my way through that one before somebody would try and assault me for assaulting and sexually assaulting their wounded comrade. Like, I'm not trying to cop a feel. I'm doing medical treatment. But this is awkward. And she's like, yep, that's why I asked. She's like, because I've brought this up with a few people and everybody gives me the same reaction. Like, I wouldn't do that. And I was like, it's not to say that I wouldn't do it, but man, like, whew, you know, are there other methods that I could do? You know, you can ram your fist into her abdominal aorta, which, you know, has its own complications and stuff. But at the end of the day, she's like, yeah, at the end of the day, it's right on the inside of her thigh, right between her legs. It's spurting. Can't get clamps on it, but you could pack that wound. Well, what do you do? I will have to think that one through. We don't even run those scenarios. Or like a through and through on the breast. Like it comes between the plates, doesn't enter the pleural space, no damage, straight up tissue, but it hits a mammary artery. Now what? How many scenarios, how many of these mannequins that we have or any of the moolahs that we have will even replicate that injury pattern? None. Haven't seen any of it. So those are the things that we are lacking. And it would be great if some of these companies and our folks down at MedCOE, I know they're working on it right now, but these are the injury patterns. These are the things that we need to really focus on to help all the other folks, even the non-medical and medical folks, get past those initial two scenarios that we've seen consistently, that it takes them up into the third run before they finally get past that mental block, whether it's social or cultural or, you know, whatever is blocking them from doing the proper procedures and make it gender neutral.
So, I mean, I guess what's wrong with us when there's been armies around the world for years and years and years have had females as part of their military? I guess, why did they figure it out, or have they figured it out, and we're so far behind?
Honestly, it's kind of a mix. So I know the reports that are coming out of Ukraine are kind of mixed. We're not able to get the real casualty estimates, except for I did notice the 21% female medevac. That seemed a large amount, considering what our female medevacs were. It was definitely not that high. I talked to a couple guys that worked medevac, and even like some 160 dudes, and they were just like, yeah, no, our numbers weren't that high ever. Like, it was probably in the single digits. And even our fatality rates among our females throughout GWAT, you know, over 20-something years, is like 2%. But it goes beyond. I had been asked, it was like, was that all military for the Ukrainian military? And I was like, no. I was like, I don't know. It didn't break it up on military versus civilians or people caught in the crossfire or NGOs that are working out there, Red Cross and Red Crescent and stuff. But that doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it's still females on the battlefield. And if we're not understanding how to treat them, then how many of them potentially are going to die from these injury patterns, because we're not focused on that and we're not thinking it through on some of these physiological or social issues that are still there. Throughout the Middle East, again, the Saudis are actually ramping up their female nursing corps right now because of the princess. She's an RN, and she has made it very clear that she wanted the king and MBS, the heir, to ramp up some female training within their military, and they've actually built her an entire medical compound for teaching females, female specific over there, because the men are not allowed to touch the women. So if they did have female support personnel doing whatever they're doing down south, they wouldn't be able to be treated by the male medics or the male doctors. They would have to wait for a female to show up. And so this is one of those shortcomings that around the world in certain places, they just don't have it. Even in Mexico, when Yushu was doing the study, the females were still having problems trying to treat the males as well. So it's a back and forth. We are not good, and most of the folks that we work with are not great at trying to figure out keeping it gender neutral. I would say the northern Scandinavian folks are one of the few that I've heard some positive stories about. It just doesn't matter to them. They take showers together, co-ed completely. Anything goes. Like, everything is open for training. They're not going to, you know, close their eyes and do this kind of stuff. It is, but that's a cultural thing for them. Like, they are born that way, and they are born into a culture that is not something taboo. So in other places, in a lot of the countries that we work with, it is kind of taboo to be touching women in that way, even if it's not in a sexual nature. If they're injured anywhere near their genitalia or their breast, it's going to cause some consternation with them.
So, I mean, that's, I guess, one holdup that I can definitely see is just in sharps training. Mm-hmm. That absolutely everybody receives over and over and over and over and over again until you comply. But I think that's a completely separate topic from the medicine that we're trying to talk about. But do you think that there's some kind of overlap or problem, I guess, between those two things? Medical treatment, absolutely different than sexual harassment.
And this is where in my paper, it specifically talks about, in the civilian sector, multi-system trauma patients that are female have a higher survivability rate. But when we're looking at it on the military side, they have a higher fatality rate. What's the discrepancy here? I think some of it is going to be the social cultural issues, sharp being part of it. When I've mentioned some of the issues that came up with the 82nd, like 7-8 years ago, with the hypothermia patient and then the heat casualty patient, the hypothermia patient and the medic doing the proper procedures, you know, female, uncontrolled shivering, can't answer my questions, likelihood of hypothermia there, but he has to rule out seizures or any other differentials. So what is the protocol? 100% core temp. And when the platoon sergeant or the senior NCO was looking at the medic, like, he's getting ready to pull your pants down and insert a rectal thermometer, he starts freaking out. He's like, what are you doing? You're a pervert. Stop that. And he's like, well, no, I need to rule out and make sure this is hypothermia so I can treat properly, because if it's not hypothermia and she's not, you know, the shivering that she's doing is from, like, a seizure or whatever, I need to treat that differently than wrapping her up in HPMK and getting her warm and getting more fluids on board. And the senior NCO is like, I will charge you with UCMJ if you do that. And he was like, nope, I know I'm right. This is the protocol. He shoves it in. They had to go to a court-martial proceeding. They charged him with UCMJ for sexual assault because he put a rectal thermometer in a female, which wound up having hypothermia. Battalion surgeon, PA, senior medic all had to go before the battalion commander and everybody else and defend the kid. But what is the long-term effects? What's the secondary and tertiary effects of that? Now you have this medic who followed medical protocols getting railroaded with UCMJ, and everybody's having to defend him. What are the secondary effects? Like, you just had, and this is right at the same exact time that the 11 Bravo females were first, like within the first 3 months of them being accepted in the 82nd, this event occurred. And then you fast forward 6 more months, they had a heat casualty, same thing happened. They're on a ruck march out past the DZs at Fort Bragg in August. So it's hot, it's humid, girl collapses. They take her rucksack off. They drag her to the shade. They take her top off. They throw water on her. They're starting to loosen her belt and loosen her clothing. And she screams, "Don't rape me." All 10 dudes, you know, her whole squad, like, jumps backwards. Leader gets on the radio and is like, "Hey, I'm at this grid coordinate. I need a female here now." And they left her for like 20, 30 minutes until a female medic showed up. And then she's yelling at him, like, "What are you guys doing? Why aren't you fanning her? Why aren't you getting water on board?" And they're like, "Hey, she screamed, 'Don't rape me.' No means no. Bend a sharp. I know what that means. I'm not touching her." "No, this is a medical emergency." And they're like, no means no. I'm not touching her. It's not worth any of our careers if she says that we did something else inappropriate to her. She can sit there." And I've asked colonels and sergeant majors and even GOs, I've been like, "Okay, let's just go crazy scenario. Heat stroke and she died. What are the consequences to those teammates?" "Oh, I'd smoke them all. Yeah, they're all out of the army. They failed her, you know, blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, "Okay, so you had your sharp EO rep tell them that a medical emergency is gender neutral. You told this to your 11 Bravos or your, you know, 11 Charlies, whatever they are. You told this to non-medical staff that they can do whatever steps they need to, even when she says no." And then they all get that look like, "Oh, no." I was like, "Yeah. So you're going to smoke these guys' careers because she said one thing. They took it as no. No means no. And now she dies. Well, it's an altered mental status." No. We're not talking about the medical side of this now. We're talking about the legal side of this. You have not said that this is gender neutral. They are following what they know. They're not medical experts. They don't understand the difference between medical emergencies, gender neutrality, triage, and all this stuff because we haven't focused on this. And so a number of these senior folks are just like, "Maybe we should have this conversation." I was like, "You should." And at the end of the day, that is the solution. Sharp is there for a reason. EO is there for a reason. But at the end of the day, there are medical emergencies. And this is why when I've talked to ER docs in the military, I've said, "Do you guys even have this problem?" They're like, "Ah, no, I don't have that problem." I was like, "Okay, but when you first treated the opposite sex, when you were first going through med school or residency or whatever else, how was that?" "Oh, it was awkward. It was super awkward." "Oh, so you did have a problem with it until you treated a few patients of the opposite sex, whether male or female." And they're like, "Oh, yeah, I guess, yeah, now that you put it that way, yeah, I did have that problem." I was like, "But I don't have that problem now." I was like, it's all gender neutral. It's like, it's just triage. You do what you do." And I'm like, "But you're a medical professional who has been to a years of schooling," or like paramedics that I've spoken with that have years of training, or nurses. Same thing. We're talking about engineers. We're talking about combo guys, infantry people. They don't have years of training. Even with the Combat Lifesaver course, I don't think anything in there is talking about gender neutrality. It's you do the treatments, but no, we're not discussing what could potentially go wrong if you're not thinking that through. So,
yeah. So obviously in hospitals, they're part of the military as well. They're receiving sharp training. Do they just ignore all that part? And, or is it actually different?
So I think they get the same guidance. It's just the doctrine that they run off of. And this is just coming from the docs, nurses, and paramedics and stuff, both civilian side and military that, you know, worked at TGH down here in Tampa and, you know, spoke with the Tampa Fire guys and just kind of picked their brain on stuff. And they're like, "Oh, no, that's not even an issue." But on the military side, they're like, "Well, yeah, I mean, they're sharp. But if I have a female with altered mental status, I don't care. Like, if she is clearly not thinking properly, then I'm not taking what she's saying to me. She could tell me no, and I'm still going to set the bone. Or she could tell me no, and I'm still going to do whatever procedure I need to do because she needs it, because it's a medical emergency. And if I don't do this, she's going to get worse. And what do we take the oath for? We're not here to do harm. We're here to help them. They may not even know that they need the help because whatever's going on up here from a TBI or, you know, they could have eaten something or drank something or took a pill that just reacted poorly with them. they don't know what's going on. And so that's normally the response that I get. And that's why on the military side, they're like, no, we'll take SHARP into consideration, but not if it's an emergency. If it's a medical emergency, no, that all goes out. And we are doing what is medically necessary for them to stay alive and to be treated properly.
So if you, let's say, King for a day, King McGraw for the day, and you wanted to fix this problem, what would you do?
I would definitely enter into the SHARP EO program that there's a medical emergency portion. I would, you know, collaborate, you know, get the folks from COTSI involved, get the folks from DHA involved, have them sit down and write out like some sort of protocol to even talk about it. You know, at the end of the day, I don't want somebody to weaponize this. I don't want somebody to use this so they can take advantage of somebody. But it still needs to be discussed. It goes back to the hypothermia case. They walked away from her. If she had wound up having heat stroke, potentially died, like, this girl's parents are going to be like, why would you ever leave her? Like, you know that she wasn't in her right mind. She's talking erratically. You should have treated our daughter and saved her life. Like, I mean, I've got a 27-year-old, 19-year-old daughter and a 17-year-old daughter and then three sons that are teenagers. I wouldn't want anybody to not treat my kid because of something that they said when they weren't thinking properly or they had altered mental status.
But Dan, I could have gotten in trouble.
With the Venmo debit card, you can Venmo everything. Your favorite band's merch, you can Venmo this. Or their next show, you can Venmo that. Visit Venmo.me/debit to learn more. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated. Card may be used everywhere MasterCard is accepted. Venmo purchase restrictions apply.
On WhatsApp, no one can see or hear your personal messages. Whether it's a voice call, message, or sending a password. To WhatsApp, it's all just this. So whether you're sharing the streaming password in the family chat or trading those late night voice messages that could basically become a podcast, your personal messages stay between you, your friends, and your family. No one else, not even us. WhatsApp, message privately with everyone.
Sorry, it says recording stopped. Are you good?
Not for me. We're still good.
Yeah,
I could have gotten in trouble.
You know, that is where having this addition to the SHARP EO protocols would be beneficial, because then they're already having these conversations and they're able to talk through at least a couple of the scenarios of what can happen. I only gave you the hypothermia and the hot weather and cold weather injury, you know, examples, but I'm sure there's going to be more out there. You know, for me, I've had TBIs multiple times, you know, airborne ops and everything else. I've cracked my skull on a drop. I saw stars, but let's say I have a female and she screws her back up. Okay. Well, I'm trying to like roll her and I'm trying to move her and I have to grab her hips to stabilize her. And then she screams at me that I'm fondling her. No, I'm trying to make sure that if you wind up having a hip fracture, it doesn't get worse and then you bleed more internally. Like, I'm going to be holding you in a position that you may not like it. It may come across in an inappropriate manner, but that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help you. Just as an example, there's going to be numerous ones out there, but this is where we need to start looking at this. Talk to the females. Ask them whenever they might have felt inappropriate touching or when they felt that something was just a little off, and then have that conversation. Add it to the protocols. I mean, we do this in our SHARP scenarios. We have people walk up on stage and give us some weird scenarios where they're sexually harassing their coworker in like a live play up on the stage at Fort Bragg. And it's weird, but okay, so have the medics throw a medical scenario in there as an option. You know, have them at least discuss it, talk about it so that they don't feel awkward. And it just goes back to the trauma situations. Why are we having females that show up at the cache with their clothes on, whereas every other male that was on the bird showed up trauma naked? And then in some cases, those females have wound up dying. That doesn't make any sense to me. For me, that's people not talking about this and not working through that
this is a medical emergency. We need to get over the modesty thought process. We need to get over the social and cultural issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other things we need to talk about, at least on this topic?
I don't think so. I think that's pretty solid on that. I mean, there are answers out there and there's some solutions. It's just trying to get after it. What would work best? I mean, you and I both agree. We hate throwing problems out there without a solution. I think just having at least a discussion about it, and then in the training protocols, you know, with MedCOE for the 68 whiskeys and what the Navy's running, the Air Force is running for their medical scenarios, start, you know, having the female scenarios included in there. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I appreciate it, Dan. That's it for today's podcast. Make sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Check out our free downloads and a ton of other helpful information. Grab a bag of our fresh roasted PFC coffee, links in the description below, and stay on the bleeding edge of combat and austere medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out.